Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Alex Beard, whose new children's book is The Lion King. We'll also hear from essayist Josh Wheeler, who's the author of Acid West. Beard is a fabulous artist and children's book author. The last time we spoke was about his gorgeous art book, A Brush with Nature, Abstract Naturalism and the Painting of Life. Today we're talking about his most recent children's book, The Lion King, the latest entry in his series, Tales from the Watering Hole. It's a serious story with a big sense of humor. Alex Beard, welcome back to The Reading Life.
I'm so happy to be here. It's such a pleasure to sit with you.
Oh, now The Lion King is a companion book to The Jungle Grapevine, Monkey See, Monkey Draw, and Crocodile's Tears. It's a cautionary tale of untruths and how rampant they are in the jungle. So I wonder where this came from, Alex.
So let's say that the Tales from the Watering Hole as a collection have been for me for many years a device to be able to use the parable and animals to reflect back on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So The Jungle Grapevine is about rumors, and Crocodile's Tears is about the environment, and The Lion King is about integrity and telling the truth.
Yes, and a warthog is an unlikely king, no?
A warthog, in this case, is an entirely appropriate king, because there needs to be some buffoonery in order to see the truism behind the ridiculousness of lying.
Mm-hmm. And the lesson is that as the warthog rules his kingdom, lies spread, life becomes unsettling.
Yeah, completely discombobulated, in fact. I mean, I would suggest that the one underpinning of civilization is the telling of the truth and the striving for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, we as a nation, and I'm not going to take this into a political direction, but it doesn't change the fact that the city on the hill is defined by its pursuit of integrity and truth, all the way back to the original conceit of we take these truths to be truthful, right? I mean, we take these to be inalienable rights, which to me suggests the nature of we as human beings. There are certain truths which dictate what we are entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just what we are allowed to have, but what we are entitled to strive for and the rules under which we strive for them. Now, we happen to be in a political environment where both sides and the middle are all accusing each other of lying, which does not get anybody anywhere. So there needs to be some kind of basic moral conversation, in my mind at least, mm-hmm. about the fact that you cannot do business if you're doing business with somebody who is telling you a lie. And you cannot be friends with somebody who doesn't tell you the truth. And you cannot be led by those who are unwilling to strive for truthfulness in their approach to the populace.
Absolutely. This is a bright, fanciful, funny book with a serious message. And how does this go over with kids themselves? Do you read these books to your kids? How do they react to them?
My kids just roll their eyes. Just like, God, Dad, you're going to read me another book.
Again.
You know, when I set out to do a book like this, I do a few tests.
Mm-hmm.
I get a couple of kids together in my studio and I'll read a draft to them. Or when it's finished, I had my daughter's Girl Scout troop come to the studio and I sat down with something like 28-year-olds. And then I'm interested in their parents as well.
Right.
The nature of the illustrated picture book is that it's one of the few devices that doesn't really translate yet into the technological digital environment.
And thank goodness for that.
It's about reading, turning pages, and sitting on your parents' knees.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then as a result, I'm very focused on how is the message in the book being interpreted by the children and by their parents? And how does that open a conversation for the two of them to be able to talk about what the book is, what the book's theme is?
Right.
Right. So in this case, I find it fascinating. Some people, and this will be the only time that I will mention his name, immediately think this book is about Trump. Other people don't make the association at all. They just think it's a parable about lying. Mm-hmm. And my version of it, is, of course, is that this is a book about life.
Of course.
It's not about an individual. It's about the nature of what happens to those who lie. Mm-hmm. Lesson that we were all taught as children, that now, as we're in an environment where lying is pervasive, how do you explain to your children that it's not okay when it seems like the liars are getting away with it?
Right.
So we're still in the middle of the lie. So as a result, we don't see the end. But there are no cards in this deck where the liars come out on top. It's just not the nature of life.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, my experience has been that the children who have read this or been read to about this understand that the warthog is full of it.
Of course.
Right? Because the lies are obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And that that's not acceptable. And so that is mission accomplished in my mind. It doesn't need to translate to who's the individual that it may or may not be about, because it's about the archetype.
And children are basically, I don't think children lie.
Not
very well, not very often. I think their basic impulse is to tell the truth, unless, well, you know, the broken cookie jar. I mean, stuff
you
like
know,
that.
I think to my own children, and I think that there is in our nature, just as there is in nature, the nature to lie. And what I mean by that is a chameleon will change its colors so that you don't see it. And the zebra has stripes so that it's unclear as to one versus the other.
Mm-hmm.
And after a fashion, those are untruths. But they're fundamentally true to their nature. And we as people are fundamentally true to the idea of non-confrontation.
Ah.
Right? And
yeah.
Lying is a means of confrontation. Because it inevitably leads to it,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that children will do what they can get away with. But my own children, if you catch them bold-faced in a who broke the cookie jar and one of them did and says that they didn't, you can tell right away because they ultimately know that they're liable for it.
Right.
They
right.
know they're going to get caught and they're trying to see if they can get away with it, but it's pretty clear right away that they can't. So that's part of the nature of this book as well, is I want to remind people that you don't get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, you lose your crown.
Well, when you write a book like this, do you amuse yourself with what you do? I mean, I've always been very curious about that.
I don't. I beat myself up about it a little bit.
Really?
Yeah,
oh.
Because I want it to be as good as it possibly can be, because I think that the messages that I have to relay are important.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, I want my telling of that tale to be done as adroitly as possible so that other people will find it funny.
Yeah.
Right? Because ultimately, if you want to get your message across in this case, in something which is so charged, you need to be able to laugh at it a little bit.
You right? have to.
So I impress myself occasionally with a turn of phrase, which I think, wow, that's really pretty clever, until I get a week into it. And I've changed the phraseology, and all of a sudden, my darling needs to be killed.
Of course.
You know, so there's
the great heartbreak.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And
oh, but
it's like tacking across a lake as opposed to just sailing with the wind in your sails behind you.
And you look at it, and it's such a bright and cheerful book.
I mean,
that's really a wonderful trick. I mean, to have such a serious.
Well, I try to be a pretty cheerful fellow.
You are.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, I think you work hard, you tell the truth, and you're nice to people, and it gets you pretty far.
And that's what you do. You
right?
work hard.
Well, I try, right? And so this falls into that category.
And you work hard in a lot of areas. I know you're just back from Africa.
I am. That's true.
Summer journey.
Yeah.
So tell us about the Watering Hole Foundation and what you're working on there.
Okay. So the Watering Hole Foundation I created, I guess, 5 or 6 years now as a means for me to give back to the communities that I visit when I'm in East Africa. You know, the people that are on the ground fighting to save the wilderness that I love so much need as much help as they can get. And I'm just not dripping with money. So I'm not in a position to just write checks and hope for the best. So what I do have the ability to do is spread the word and make art.
Mm-hmm.
So I created the Watering Hole Foundation in the first place so that when I went over to track elephants on foot and sleep under an acacia tree with a mosquito net, that I could then make art while I was there, come back, earmark that artwork to sell through the Watering Hole Foundation to then give proceeds back to the communities that I was wandering around with to help save the environment that I love, right?
And this is a longstanding concern of yours. You first went to Africa as a very young person.
I did. I started going in the 1980s as a teenager. And so I've been involved peripherally for more than 30 years now with, mm-hmm. with the effort to save the elephants and the wildlife in East Africa and the dynamics of overpopulation and human-wildlife conflict and natural resources, et cetera, right? I mean, we all have a concentration on the environment, especially here in New Orleans where it's so close and personal. And this just happens to be my version, one of my versions of it. So this summer I was in northern Kenya and I went off on a couple of camel safaris and tracking elephants and sort of checking on the frontier of the north. And I have to say there was good rains this year and lots of wildlife, and I got very close to being stung by a little scorpion, which I could have avoided. I saw a couple of spitting cobras, which I also would have just as soon not. And one night, we had lions all in our camp. So we're sitting around our dinner table, which is really like a picnic table that you put on the back of a camel and you break it down, you set it up underneath a bassia tree with a like the kind of tablecloth that would really hang on a collegiate wall more than anything else, right? and we're all having dinner, and all of a sudden, the lions are just on the other side of camp. And it was clear that there were two or three of them because they were sort of circling us, and we could hear them calling to each other. Now, the reality is that the lions are—and now I should tell you that in the context of this, we're not in a lodge, right? I mean, I'm sleeping in a
You're
pup
out
tent.
There.
Yeah, we're sleeping in a pup tent on the ground. And the reality is, of course, that the lions are much more interested in the camels than they are in you. That doesn't make it any less exhilarating.
Yeah. Exhilarating is a nice word for that.
Yeah, right? I mean, it'll keep you awake for a little while if the lions get close enough. And I've had experience over the years with lions coming in and out of camp. And mostly they don't bother you. They do occasionally go after the camels. There's a nice metaphor in here. So in order to drive away the lions at night, you get out of your tent, you stand together, and you shine a light on them.
Oh, wow.
Right? So
that's a lovely metaphor.
Yeah. So I think in the context of The Lion King and the book that I'm currently off, you know, proselytizing about, I think that that fits rather nicely. There mm-hmm. are lions in camp at home, too.
Yes.
Right? And so we need to stand together and shine a light on it to drive them away until the sun rises again.
Oh, Alex, you're always such a light yourself. I mean, I think your life is so admirable. It's so purposeful, you know? And now you're giving this gift to your own children of the experiences that you had in Africa. And
I was always told that the best education is travel and experience. Mm-hmm. And not everybody is lucky enough to be able to, you know, pick up roots and go off for the summer and bring their kids and like that. I happen to be lucky because my wife is a teacher, so she has the time away and I have the experience there to be able to follow up on it. But if you don't then push your children to that same understanding that we live in a global environment, which is localities all together, we end up in this territorial mess.
Yes,
right,
indeed.
Where we look at each other as other. And it's important to look at each other as together.
Mm-hmm. And New Orleans still holds its charm for you, too.
Oh, there's no place else I would live anywhere in the world. For sure.
We
Absolutely.
Are so lucky.
You know, I'm from New York City, as you know, mm-hmm. originally. And when I would come back from a month or more in the bush and come back into New York, I'd have knots in my neck. Right? I mean, I'm back, and what a misery. And I love New York, right? So as this gets broadcast up to Manhattan, hello to all of you, and I'm not meaning to insult you, but when I get back to New Orleans, I have butterflies in my stomach, right? This is a place where there are creative people doing creative things creatively. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what more could you ask for?
Oh, we're very lucky. We are indeed.
For sure.
We've been talking with Alex Beard, whose new book for children of all ages is The Lion King. You can meet him at Art for Art's Sake in October, that first Saturday, and the book is available at his gallery at 3926 Magazine Street. Alex, thank you so much.
It is always a pleasure to be with you.
Telling me those lies, lies, lies.
In his new essay collection, Acid West, Josh Wheeler takes us to his New Mexico. Not the rarefied air of Taos and Santa Fe, but southern New Mexico, S&M as he calls it. He's from Alamogordo, and now he teaches creative writing at Louisiana State University. And he's recently moved to New Orleans, so I can't wait to hear what's next. Josh Wheeler, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time since I've read a book with such a strong sense of place. And your New Mexico, it's not the New Mexico most of us think of when we think of that state. How did growing up in Alamogordo turn you into a storyteller?
Well, I don't know about Alamogordo broadly, but certainly my family is full of storytellers. Uh-huh. I come from an old ranching family, and so it's full of lots of cowboys and cowgirls who were always telling stories. In fact, if you talk to them, they'd say I was the quiet one who had very little to say. But you were listening. Yeah, that's true. I was listening, I was learning, I was parsing, trying to figure out who we were and what this place was that we were from. So we've been there a relatively long time, I think, compared to other people. Our family's been there since the late 1800s. But,
wow.
Of course, the culture there is very old. And you see, you know, remnants of the Spanish culture and, of course, the Mexican culture. And it all blends there in a way that's very interesting, especially when you start throwing in the space industry and and the military-industrial complex. It becomes just a one-of-a-kind area.
One of the things you do so well in these essays is render real sadness and the legacy of the atomic bomb tests, for example, in cancer in generations of people. But you temper that sadness with real, justified outrage, of course. And you seem to look at these essays as a way of honoring your people and honoring their struggle in the face of all this.
Yeah, I think the story of the downwinders, which is the folks who were exposed to radioactive fallout after the first test of an atomic bomb, is real indicative of what happens in New Mexico. Despite the fact that the government's been paying restitution to people who have been exposed to radiation and all aspects of the nuclear energy complex, the first people to be exposed to it via weapons blast were in and around Alamogordo in the Tularosa Basin. And yet their story was never really told. And even in Alamogordo and the surrounding areas, this was sort of a point of pride, right? That we took a hit for the nation,
right?
When they really needed it. And that was kind of the story that I grew up with. But it wasn't the real story. And I write about Tina Cordova, who's the woman who's spent a long time working very hard to organize the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. She recently, just finally, after years of hard work, got to testify before Congress. So hopefully they'll be getting some sort of restitution for what they've been through. But just that idea that we tell our stories in a way that sort of gives us agency and makes us feel proud mm-hmm. to be patriots, especially in a state that people often forget about being part of the country. There are all of these things that are going on in New Mexico, and we tend to want to, as New Mexicans, show the bright side, mm-hmm. right? Our state motto is the land of enchantment.
Yes.
And that's certainly there. And most of the writing that you find about New Mexico focuses on that. I hate to say that I wrote a sad book. I don't think it is a sad book, but
no,
I think it's
I
a book that celebrates in some way the suffering and the overcoming mm-hmm. that people in that region dealt with.
I remember the first time I went to New Mexico, I just thought it was the most beautiful place I'd ever seen.
Where did you go?
Santa Fe and Abiquiu and Albuquerque. And I remember my friend who lived there telling me that people either really love that big sky or else they're driven completely crazy by it.
And sometimes both.
Yeah, I bet.
I think you have a lot of people in New Mexico who embrace the sort of madness that's fostered by the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I know that in my writing, one of the things that I wanted to try to do, and I don't know how successful I was, but was capture the feeling of the landscape, the sense of its endlessness. So yeah, that landscape is is quite different from Louisiana.
When you write about it, though, the way you describe it reminds me of that passion and attention that Jim Burke brings to Louisiana landscapes.
Sure.
I mean, you really see it and make the reader feel it. That description of the sleeping lady is just a phenomenal description.
That was maybe one of the tougher ones to settle on, I suppose, because I've been looking at that sleeping lady every day of my life since I was about 3 years old until I moved away when I was 18. And then when I came back, I was writing a lot of the book at my grandmommy and granddaddy's house, and the sleeping lady's right there. So some of those things become very familiar, and you have to find a way to make them strange again so that you can write about them as if they're new. And perhaps me moving away and going to college was part of that.
Sometime you have to go away to see it clearly.
Sure.
But tell our listeners what the Sleeping Lady is. Really.
So the Sleeping Lady is a mountain formation that is towering over Alamogordo. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see it from most places in town, though depending on where you are, it sometimes looks like a steamboat. But she's sometimes called the Lady of the Mountain, the Sleeping Lady. But she's a very recognizable symbol of Alamogordo.
Oh, it's amazing. It's beautiful writing there. To go back to all this craziness associated with New Mexico, you have a fabulous essay writing about your coverage of a UFO convention.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about that. It sounded like crazy fun.
It was a lot of fun. Roswell is a town that has had a lot of up and downs in terms of their economy, military coming in and out, gas, oil industry coming in and out. The one thing that they settled on in the early 90s that they could really, you know, kind of have a standard revenue stream with was the UFO festival. And of course, the stories of the UFO crash in Roswell have been around for a long time and have become a part of the cultural consciousness pretty much everywhere. And Roswell is interesting. They both take it very seriously and don't. Mm-hmm. So you can go to that festival even if you're a skeptic about aliens and extraterrestrial life and have a very good time and not feel like there's too many paranoid folks who are calling the extraterrestrial ancestors back home.
Right.
But if you do feel that way and you do feel that those are your ancestors, you can go there and meet other people who are like that. And so it's really just a celebration of humanity in the end, I think,
right.
The UFO festival.
And you also write about the way New Mexico has been taken advantage of, as many poor states are. And I think about that terrific essay, Truth or Consequences at the Gateway to Space, about Richard Branson's spaceport. And this is very much a story about class in America, which I thought was fascinating.
Sure. So Virgin Galactic recently completed a milestone and their spaceships are getting closer to doing what they want, which is not quite go to space, but take tourists to the
for
edge
a ride.
Of space.
Yeah.
But rich tourists, $225,000 or $250,000, I think a ticket costs now. But New Mexico basically footed the bill for the spaceport where all of this was supposed to happen in a town called Truth or Consequences. And it's going on 13 years, I think, now, and nothing's really happened out there. They're doing all of their development in California, and this town and the state, particularly the southern part of the state, has put up a lot of money for this because they were promised Brad Pitt's going to come down there and spend a lot of money and he's going to put you on the map and all of these celebrities are going to come to your restaurants and your hotels. And it may still happen, but in the 13 years since they started the project, a lot of other spaceports have been built, mm-hmm. which are a lot more accessible and are surrounded by a lot more luxury accommodations. And so every year that passes that they don't start taking tourists to space, it feels like the folks there have been fleeced.
Of course. And yet, there's so much humor in this book. For people who love weird stuff, it's just a great, great book.
I think New Mexicans are a lot like Louisianans in that they have a great sense of humor even when they're confronted with tragedy and sadness. Mm-hmm. You almost have to. I've heard from some people that the humor sometimes feels misplaced, like maybe it's not right to tell a joke when you're discussing generations of cancer that may have come from an atomic test. But when I go and speak with the people who are dealing with this, the cancer survivors and the people who are battling cancer, they're constantly telling me jokes.
Of course.
And they're dealing with it in the best way they know how, which is often with humor and often with faith. And I think faith and humor were two of the big things that I encountered in almost every story that I undertook to report for this book.
Absolutely. So what is looking for the light like for you? What is next?
Well, I hope those questions have the same answer, because whatever's next, I want to be a little bit lighter than what came before. One thing with the essays is that I worked really hard to struggle to find answers that weren't easy stories. Mm-hmm. And so even though there are stories in the essays, they're not easy narratives. It's often single moments of time that I'm trying to parse to really get at the complicated things beneath it. Just the form of the essay is all about struggling to understand something. And I think that lends itself maybe sometimes to a little bit more darker view of things. So I've gotten back into more traditional narrative and I'm working on a novel. And I think just the traditional storytelling form, even though I sometimes am wary of what it hides from us, it's really enjoyable to just give up the struggle and say, I'm going to tell a story. I want to follow characters and get to know them and love them and see where they go and see how they succeed. and fail sometimes, but hopefully succeed again in the end. So I hope this narrative project, this novel that I'm working on, is going to be fun and enjoyable for everybody.
Oh, I can't wait. So why'd you decide to move to New Orleans? You're signing up for a commute there, you know?
I've been in Baton Rouge for 3 years. I've been teaching at LSU. The creative writing program there is amazing. We've got great faculty, and we're doing a lot of wonderful things, and our students are accomplishing a lot. But since I was 18 years old, I've moved every year, every 2 years, just living that student life, trying to find a cheaper place to live. And I think part of it is that I'm just habituated to moving every couple of years. But also, New Orleans is one of the few places where I feel like I could stay a long time. Something about it feels very familiar to me.
Does it appeal to you as a subject, perhaps, in the future?
I think so. I mean, everything I encounter is a potential subject, I suppose.
Yeah.
I haven't spent enough time yet in New Orleans to really know what stories need to be told. But yeah, I don't know how to say it other than that. I feel a good vibe, you know?
Good.
I'm really enjoying it. Lots of places I go, I feel like an alien. Like I've been beamed to some place where I don't belong. But I don't feel that way in New Orleans. And that's an amazing thing.
That's a wonderful description of what it's like to live here, truly.
Or at least we've all been beamed here together, maybe.
Right. Well, certainly we've all chosen to be here now,
sure.
Which is a great thing. We've been talking with Josh Wheeler, whose new essay collection is Acid West. Watch for those atomic bombs and irradiated cows on the cover, all in acid green. Josh will be appearing at the Louisiana Book Festival this fall. Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kim Vaz-DeVille, author of Walking Ratty, The Baby Dolls of New Orleans, and Lady Hubbard, author of The Talented Ripkins, discuss their work Thursday, September 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Jonathan Schumacher, a.k.a. Mr. Shoe, nationally known for his expertise in children's literature and for igniting a passion to read, speaks Friday, September 14th from 9:30 to noon at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Schumacher is a blogger, a part-time lecturer at Rutgers University, and the ambassador of school libraries for Scholastic Book Fairs. He served on the 2014 Newbery Committee, which named the title Flora and Ulysses, The Illuminated Adventures, the most distinguished contribution to children's literature. And Library Journal has named him the Extreme Librarian. That's for the high level of exertion he uses to get kids reading. Instructor Magazine calls him a cool teacher for redefining what it means to be a teacher and librarian. The Dickens Fellowship begins its reading of the novel Little Dorrit this year. The first meeting is Saturday, September 15th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Reading for the first meeting is Book 1, Chapters 1 through 11, open to all Dickens fans. Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop is launching 3 new books Saturday, September 15th from 2 to 6 with a publication party at the shop. The new books are Alligator Bayou Crawfish, an alphabet book by Al Salino, The Two Stegosauruses by Daniel Moore Glaser, and the young adult novel Captain by Artie Sievers. And a reminder, Barnes & Noble hosts the Monday Night Writers Group every Monday night at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.